Everything that we know, everything that we experience is subject to context. It's all about context. The same comment you may hear one person making in a certain place, which is right on the mark, appropriate, is something which in another context is the most insulting, the most unexpected kind of comment that could be made. And it depends in the cultural context, family context. It all depends on the context. So with that in mind, we're told about a very unusual, or actually seemingly usual, occurrence which occurred. And the question is going to be trying to build context to that, trying to build a background to that occurrence and finding meaning in it. The story which I refer to is near the very beginning of the Haggadah, where we just had the Manishtana, all the children who got up on their chairs, everybody's said their bit. And then finally, what happens is we talk about a particular Seder which occurred historically. And by the way, you should know there are many stories of Haggadahs which occurred historically. In fact, recently, I saw a compilation of Haggadahs of all the Haggadahs printed from the earliest time of recording. And you see Haggadahs throughout the ages. And it's very fascinating to see in the pictures and the printings and what they looked like. It's very fascinating. So we quote a particular earlier edition of this of what occurred at the Seder. And it starts on the first page. And the story is we're familiar with, which is Maya said there was a particular story by Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Tarfon. So five Rabbanim who were Shalim Mesubim b'Bnei Brak. They were staying in B'nei Brak, the B'nei Brak of old. V'hayu Mesaprim b'Yetzias Mitzrayim kol Oysa HaLayla. They would talk about Yetzias Mitzrayim that entire night. Ad Shebo'u Talmidehem v'omru lohem Rabboseinu Higia Zman Kriya Shema Shel Shachris. And they continued to be enraptured in this Seder, in their talking. It was such a captivating Seder that they had to be distracted or informed by the Talmidim that already the time had come for morning to say the Kriya Shema in the morning. All familiar with the story. And the question is what's the point of it being in the Seder over here? Meaning we know what we're supposed to be doing. We're doing what we're supposed to be doing. So why are we borrowing the story? What's the significance of this story being here at this juncture? Is there something more than the fact that they're just doing what we're doing? And this is there is a precedent to what we're doing. It's certainly very nice that at the formulation point of the Haggadah, which is very early on, these Rabbanim who lived very on in the Mishnah, in the Tanatic period, these are people who are found in the Mishnah, would be talking about it. But one would beg to ask if there's more significance. And specifically so, with your permission, is to also understand geographically where these people lived. At least three of them we're told. We're told that, and this is thanks to Rabbi Yoni Gold, a colleague of mine, the map at the bottom of the page, it's fascinating to note that Rabbi Akiva actually comes from B'nai Brak. That's down at the bottom of the first page, near the left, is B'nai Brak, just off Tel Aviv. Lod is a little further south at the very bottom of the page. But Pekin, which is where Rabbi Yeshua is from, is further up in the north. So we're told that these different Rabbanim actually come from different towns. Rabbi Akiva from B'nai Brak, Rabbi Lezer from Lod, and Rabbi Yeshua from Pekin. And that, besides Rabbi Tarfon and Rabbi Yeshua, and the remaining one, which is... who's the odd one out over here? Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, who we don't have specific reference to their placement, but these people live very far away. They each have their own community. They're leaders in their own rights. And the question is, so what brought them together? What about this particular night brought them together in this place? Were they not leading their particular Sedarim in their communities? What about it was the unifying factor this night? That's one we'd like to understand. Tino, what are your thoughts? They were plotting a revolt. So there is a suggestion, an academic suggestion, that part of the reason why they got together tonight was because this was in the era of the Bar Kokhba rebellion, right? And this is in the house of Rabbi Akiva. And the suggestion is that they are plotting, or they're involved in the Bar Kokhba rebellion, because this is very soon after the destruction of the Second Temple. We're talking in the years between 70 and 130, Common Era. So it's possible that there's a plotting or an evolving of a revolt at this point in time. That's a suggestion which is on the table. The only issue with that is, what's lacking in that suggestion? What's lacking in suggestion is content. We don't know if that's relevant to the Seder. Then it doesn't refer to anything that's going on in the Seder. Meaning, there's no reference to the fact that there is anything, we'll call it sinister, going on over here. And also, why is that relevant to the Seder, though?
No, because they were using this as a cover. They were using the Seder as a cover.
Okay, so what Tim is arguing is that the Seder itself was the cover for this discussion. The only question is, if that's true, then why do we borrow it? Meaning, why would the editors of the Haggadah use it as their particular text? Meaning, for us, it bears less relevance to the Seder, although to them it was something which was protective.
It provoked questions.
So I think this is very important to consider. It's very important to consider what Tim is saying over here, which is that this is in a particular era, and in a moment we're going to actually circle back to the relevance of this era, and there should be an echo in the back of our minds. Is this connected? Is this connected to this aspect of the historical context, which is the brewing, the simmering under the surface of a torn up society trying to rebel against the Romans? There definitely is food for thought in that direction. But I'd like to come back to it perhaps with a little bit of a nuance on that, because as of now, the story itself doesn't present any support for there being a subterfuge yet. The question is in terms of who these people are.
As you pointed out,
they came from different places.
So why didn't they stay in?
Correct. So the fact that they come from different places may be an indication of that. Point well taken. Point well taken. More than the different places that they come from, I think it would be interesting in the next little bit just to explore their opinions on life as a whole, to try to put it back together and understand what's really going on at the Seder. Okay, if anybody needs, there's a few packets at the by the door. If anybody needs extras, so I'd like to investigate historically as well, moving synchronically. First through the ideas of Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. This is the Beis Halevi, not the Rav as we call as we fondly know, who lived in the last generation. Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik was actually his grandfather, the Beis Halevi, one of the earlier Soloveitchiks, and he has a particular suggestion over here based on a Gemara. Now, it looks like there's big, large text boxes, lots of Gemara. I want to move through basically four or five stories or disputes and try to see how this gives the context for the background that we're doing. So, number one, this is a Gemara on page 2 in source 1. This is a Gemara in Brachos. And what's going to fascinate us is not only what's being said, but who's saying it to. So there's a dispute. This may seem like a technical dispute, but the Gemara is going to actually illuminate what's going on over here. I'm reading in both Hebrew and English, but feel free to follow on whichever side is more comfortable. This is on page 2. Tanya, there was a Brisa, a Tanatic teaching, which had said, V'achlu es habasar b'alala hazeh. The Pasuk says that one should eat the meat that night. What meat are we referring to? Right, so there's a mitzvah to eat the Korban Pesach the night of the Seder, which is going to be coming this coming Monday night. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah Omer, so Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah would say, Ne'emar kan b'layla v'ne'emar lahalon b'va'avarti b'eretz Mitzrayim b'layla hazeh. He points out that when prescribing the mitzvah of eating the meat that night, it uses the words b'layla, that night, and elsewhere it uses the words Balala, referring to where Hashem traversed through Mitzrayim during Makas Bechoros. And what he's doing is he's using a tool called a Gzera Shava, where the common words will be our bridge, and in this sense, halachically, to tell us there's a common theme, which is Malahalon ad Chatzos, just like in that instance where Makas Bechoros had occurred at, or rather up till midnight, Afkan ad Chatzos. So we can only eat the mitzvah of eating the Korban Pesach only extends itself till midnight, or we'll call it halachic midnight, which is these days around, it's usually in the range of 12:30 to 1:30, somewhere in that range. Doesn't fluctuate too much. Omer le Rabbi Akiva, v'alo kvar ne'mar b'chipazon. Rabbi Akiva responds to Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, you have to eat the Korban Pesach b'chipazon. How would you translate that?
In haste,
right? In a rush. Ad shas chipazon, until the time that they rushed, which means when was the rush? When did the Jews leave? When did the nation of Israel leave Egypt? in the morning. So the mitzvah would extend itself until the time of rushing, which is in the morning, as opposed to midnight. Im kein matam ulama balayla. So I'm going to just skip that line. He's responding to the claim of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. But there's a machlokes on the table over here between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Till what time is the Korban Pesach eaten? Midnight, the morning. And it's based on, and it seems based on, the way they look at the psukim. Do you focus on the fact that it has this bridge word, balala hazeh, which links to another place? Or is it about that you should eat it in a chipazon, which is relating to the nation of Israel running out in a chipazon? That's the machlokas we have as follows. The Gemara extends this, takes it to the next level. And this is following the ellipses. This, by the way, takes up half a page of Gemara. So we're just focusing on the snippets which are particularly relevant. V'hani t'nai, k'hani t'nai. These two Tanaim, these two earlier sages, have the same machlokas as another pair. Who are the other pair? D'tanya, Hasam. I'm actually not sure what that word is. Hasham. I think there must be a misspelling in that word over there. Tizbach es haPesach ba'erev. There is a mitzvah to sacrifice the Pesach in the evening. Kavoah Hashemesh moed tzeischa miMitzrayim. The pasuk tells you, you sacrifice the Paschal offering in the evening, as the sun is setting, as a memory of the time of leaving Egypt. Now here the second set of Tanayim. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, be'erev ata zaver. In the evening is a sacrificing time. Ukuvua shemesh ata ochel. As the sun sets, you begin to eat. Umoed sescha amimitzrayim ata sarev. And at the time you left Egypt, you burn it. Which means, potentially it sounds like, in the morning, it sounds like. Rabbi Yeshua Omer, be'erev ata zaver, kuvua shemesh ata ochel, v'admoza ata ochel v'holech, admoed sescha amimitzrayim. So, Rabbi Yehoshua, who's here, Rabbi Yehoshua, reinterprets the psukim, moving the time somewhat backwards. Now, what's interesting about this is that we're setting up a machlokes of Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah to when is the Paschal offering eaten that night, and we align it, we put it parallel to the same machlokes as Rabbi Yehoshua and Rabbi Eliezer, dependent on learning another pasuk. And now the Gemara says, but what's really the machlokes? What's at the core? What's at the essence of this dispute? And the Gemara concludes with the following. Rabbi Abba says the following. Hakol moedim, everyone agrees, kishinigalu Yisrael mimitzrayim, lo nigalu elaba erev. When was the real redemption? When was Egypt destroyed? Was in the night. Makas Bechoros was the last clobbering, the last smashing down of Egypt to the point of submission, which occurred at night. Everybody agrees with that. God took us out at night, not physically, but symbolically, we left Egypt that night as Egypt was pulverized in the last plague. Ukashiyatsu, and everybody also agrees that when we actually left, when the nation of Israel actually left, lo yatsu elabayom, meaning the nation actually only put their foot out of the door. They only left Egypt in the morning. Everybody agrees with those two statements of fact. When Israel was effectively free and when they were practically free. Night and day. And the next day they left with a strong hand. Alma nechleku. What is the basis of this two-way dispute? Al sha'as chipazon. On the time of the rush. Rabbi Eliezer ben Azariah sover ma chipazon chipazon de Mitzrayim. Rabbi Akiva sover ma chipazon chipazon de Yisrael. Whose rush are you focusing on? Is it the rush of Egypt in their confusion, in their confounding as they're being wiped out, as the first of all their families are being killed and they realize this is submission? Or are you focusing on the rush as the nation of Israel rush out the doors? Because the eating of the Paschal lamb, the Pesach, is closely linked to the word chipazon. And the question is, who's chipazon? The confounding of the enemy or the excitement and confusion of Israel as they rush out? That's the machlokas the Gemara suggests. Now what's fascinating about this Gemara is that what we've done effectively is four of the five players of that Seder are in this Gemara. That story which we saw in the Haggadah includes four of the five people. Sorry, it includes five people. Of them, four are having this dispute. which means that if you're to sit them at the table, two of them, Rabbi Lazar, and if I'm not mistaken, I think it goes Rabbi Lazar ben Azari and Rabbi Eliezer are on one side of the table, and they say that the Pesach is only eaten until midnight, and on the other side of the table, you'll have another two of the people, Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yeshua, who would say it goes until dawn. Interesting. Now, why is that significant to a Seder? Why is when the Korban Pesach is eaten significant to the conducting of a Seder? So we need to know when to start. We're also replicating. What's important is we don't have the Korban Pesach anymore, but our Seder is very much based experientially. We say, Ba'avur zeh, b'shah she'esh matzo maru munachim lefonecha. Ba'avur zeh, when we say, because of this God took us out of Mitzrayim, zeh is an exemplifying statement. In other words, you can point at something. Zeh, this. What is it, the this? It means that there has to be something about the Exodus, something about the freedom which is in front of you. So as much as the mitzvahs are extant, as the mitzvah is still there, and we're obliged to follow it, that's when we're obliged to talk about it too. Take away the mitzvah. When the mitzvah ends, be it Pesach or be it Matzah or Maror, then no longer is the requirement of speaking about it the same. So, effectively, the machlokes that is existing in this Gemara of between four of the five people of the Seder is, when does the Seder actually go to? When should we and could we be talking about Yetzias Mitzrayim, dependent on when we can eat the Korban Pesach? And the question is, Chatzos, midnight, or the morning? And when does the Seder go to? It goes to the morning. It goes to the morning. Which means that somehow, something about this Seder is now clarifying, crystallizing the halacha in a particular way, that two people in the Seder are submitting to another two people in the Seder. Interesting? You see that? Rabbi Elazar ben Azari and Rabbi Eliezer are submitting, it seems, to the other two Tanayim in regards to how long the Seder should actually go, because it goes till the morning.
It happens in every family.
It happens in every family. The question is, the question on the table is, why? Why is it? Now, it's very important. It's very important. Why is it? Why is it that it's significant that this is occurring? That this Seder somehow is exemplifying the formation of the halacha that Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah is not sticking to his guns, he's paskening like Rabbi Akiva. And somehow it's so significant that this Seder is being quoted as part of the text of our Haggadah for a particular purpose. Tina, what were your thoughts? True, absolutely true. The mitzvah of Sippur is dependent on the actual mitzvah being in front of you. So therefore, to the extent that the matzah extends and that night is when the mitzvah is. Now, we today, just out of interest, we today try to bridge both. And that's the reason why we try to finish eating the afikomen before midnight, we try. But we still talk afterwards, just in case the other opinion continues. We try to bridge, okay? Just as out of interest. But at this point in time, there's no negotiations here. It's not a half. They effectively, by carrying on speaking, they are agreeing. They are submitting to the opinion that the mitzvah continues all night, and the talking which goes along with that mitzvah goes on the entire night. And that's very significant somehow. That may be a entrance or a passage into understanding the relevance of the Seder. So why?
Which Torah on which side?
Rabbi Elazar ben Azari and Rabbi Akiva are the first machlokes, and if I'm not mistaken, Rabbi Elazar ben Azari says midnight, Rabbi Akiva says the morning.
Rabbi Akiva says the morning.
Exactly. So Rabbi Akiva is the, and then it's parallel to Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Eliezer. I'm not 100% sure just from scanning which way it is, because it depends how they darshan the last part of the pasuk. But for our purposes over here, the halacha is like Rabbi Akiva. Ruth, what are your thoughts? Not clear. So we're going to have to pinpoint it a little further. It's a little later. We're going to be able to pinpoint the exact year in just a moment. Okay? Yes. What was that?
Does it have something to do with the time? Because I know in Barakah they're also talking about when.
Right, so there is actually, interestingly enough, and I hadn't thought about this further, is that the Gemara itself, the introduction to this Gemara, was discussing Kriya Shema itself. So I wonder if that's got to do with it as well. I don't remember, though. I don't remember what he... Right. Right, right. And there's a lot of significance to that as well, independently of this as well. But the Gemara starts off with that, so it would be fascinating. I need to go back to that and check. Rabbi Abba is a later, is an Amora. So here's just what Rabbi Abba is doing is he's summarizing the opinions. He's living many generations later. He summarizes the opinions and he says, you know what I think makes sense when analyzing this machlokes is, what's the focus of the miracle? Okay? Now, this is what Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik suggests. And by the way, with a short tangential point over here, actually before we get to the tangential point, the reason why Rav Soloveitchik suggests that Rabbi Akiva is triumphant is because the Seder occurs in his town. And the Gemara says that B'nei Brak Holchin Acha Rabbi Akiva. B'nei Brak is Rabbi Akiva's town, and therefore the halacha in his town is obviously going to follow him. And therefore, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, who is the visitor, will be the one to submit to the opinion of Rabbi Akiva. That's the suggestion which Rav Soloveitchik makes. And in fact, it helps understand the following paragraph in the Haggadah. If you just turn back for 1 second to the first page, this is the directly following paragraph in the Haggadah, which is, Omer Rebbe Elazar ben Azariah, Rebbe Elazar ben Azariah says, Hare ani keven shivim shana, I am like 70 years old, v'lo zachisi, I did not merit sheteh omer yetzias mitzrayim balelos. I could not get other people to believe that you should mention yetzias mitzrayim on a nightly basis. Ad shedrosha ben Zoma, until Ben Zoma found a drosha, and the drosha goes on to show you how he learns out that you should learn to say it at nights. Now let's just analyze this for just 1 second. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, if you believe in what you say for a particular reason, tell them the particular reason and let them believe you too. If you don't have a foundation for your belief, then why do you believe it? Why is Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah stuck? He says, I've got my hands tied behind my back. I can't make anybody believe me until Ben Zoma comes along and helps me. But what's the foundation for your belief? If you really think Yetzias Mitzrayim should be mentioned on a nightly basis, then say it. Tell them. Bring them over to your side. Why do you need Ben Zoma to now substantiate, to augment you, to give the proof that everybody's missing? Do you see the problem? The issue is, they're speaking on different wavelengths. Because Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah understands, when was the miracle, when was the actual redemption process, the redemptive process, it began at night. That's the way he views things. So if you were to ask him, when does it make most sense on a daily basis to mention Yetzias Mitzrayim, it would be at night. But if you're speaking to Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Akiva's table, and Rabbi Akiva's, the people who believe in Rabbi Akiva's approach, when did the real redemption occur? In the morning. So Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says, my hands are tied behind my back. I can stamp my foot and say as much as I like that we should mention Yetzias Mitzrayim on a nightly basis, but they don't understand me because we're on different wavelengths. They think the redemption occurred in the morning. I need somebody else to bring an external drasha to convince them. Do you see what's happening over here? Because this paragraph actually is not relevant to the Seder. Mentioning Yetzias Mitzrayim on a nightly or daily basis has got nothing to do with Pesach. That is something we mention in Kriyas Shema every day. That's got nothing to do with Pesach. The reason it's brought over here is because it represents the worldview of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, which is the redemption really occurred at night. And that's what he's shouting about. That's why he needed Ben Zoma to supplement him as a tangential point. Right over here, we put a period, we put an end to the end of the thoughts of Rav Soloveitchik, and I'd like to take it to the next level. This is just the beginning. This is the thoughts of Rav Soloveitchik. Let's take it to really to make this even more meaningful, even more substantive than before. Historical context. This is a Gemara in Gittin, which a number of people are familiar with. This is on page 3. The Gemara in Gittin says the following: In the year 66 Common Era, the Israelites, who for already a century had been under Roman dominion, had been Roman governors over the state of Judea, now started rebelling. And at this point in time, the Romans sent the army and for a number of years laid siege to Jerusalem. And so moving into the Gemara in Gittin, the Gemara says, Shadra iluvei laaspusinos Caesar. So Vespasian, Caesar, was then sent to Jerusalem, besieged for 3 years. So he was there for 3 years. There were 3 rich people in Jerusalem at the time. Their names are Nakdimon ben Gurion, ben Kalva Savua, ben Tzitzis HaKesef. These are the names of these gentlemen. Chad Omar, and each one of them makes a promise. One of them says, Ana Zayne Lehulu Bechiti Vesari. One says, I will sustain Jerusalem under siege with wheat and barley. I will sustain them with wine, oil, and salt. And the other one says, I'll give them wood, firewood, to keep them warm during the winter. So they put their cards on the table. They're very rich people, exceptionally rich. And the Gemara actually in the ellipses describes how rich. They had so much resources, they were able to sustain Jerusalem under siege for 21 years. 21 years. But woe to us, havu buhu hanu biryani. In the city were also biryani. Biryani they don't translate in this translation, but biryani were a different faction. People translate as the troublemakers, but there was a different faction of Jews as they were at this period of time. There are many factions, unfortunately. And what do they say? Amruhu lehu rabbanon. They said to the rabbis, Nepuk v'navid shalma bahadayu. Let's make peace. Let's draft a peace contract with the Romans outside. Lo shavkinu, they didn't allow them. Amr luhu, nepuk v'navid krova bahadayu. Let's at least fight them. Don't stay in the city, go out and fight them. Amr luhu rabbanon, loy mistaya milsa. We don't have the strength to fight them. Komu kal'inhu lahanol amvori dechiti v'sari v'havu kapno. What they did was they burnt the storehouses, forcing the hands of the nation of Israel to go out into war. They burnt the storehouses which could have kept them under siege safely. The sad thing about this story is this story is not the exception. The story is the rule. Is that although on the surface, the Roman Empire destroyed Judea, destroyed the Jews, or the base of Migdash in Jerusalem, it was really a representation of the inner struggle which destroyed ourselves. There were many factions. The Prushim, the Tzedukim, the Baitusim. There were these the Biryonim, who would not listen to the rule of the rabbis, who had a particular agenda, who had a way of running things. There were factions, and that's why when you hear, it's thrown out there cheaply, that the second Beis Hamikdash was destroyed because of sinas chinam, baseless hatred. It doesn't just mean, that people were, just not getting along. It means to say that society as a whole was factionalized. There were different groups, and different groups were not prepared to get along with one another. To the extent that they were prepared to sacrifice their security for their ideals. And this became unfortunately the mode of operation of the time, and the Beis Hamikdash was destroyed. This was the beginning of the complete downfall of Jerusalem, despite its fortification, despite the sustenance and the resources that it had. And that's why at this particular juncture in time, just on the next page of Gomorrah, but I put it just below here in the same box, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who is the leader of Jerusalem at the time, manages to escape. He pretends to have died. He gets out in a coffin, and he speaks to Vespasian. And he impresses Vespasian in his introduction, and he makes three requests. He's given three requests before Vespasian is replaced by Titus. And he says the following, and this is the famous line in the bottom of the source 2. Omer lei, he says to Vespasian, Tein li Yavne v'chachomel, give me Yavne and her wise men, v'shoshilso de Rabban Gamliel, and the chain of Rabban Gamliel, Vasvasa de Messiah lay Rabbi Tzadok, and the physicians to heal Rabbi Tzadok, who had been fasting for 40 years as a spiritual way of trying to put a band-aid on the deteriorating society that had been living up till now. And the interesting thing is about the first two requests is that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was criticized. Maybe he should have pushed the envelope further. Maybe he should have tried to save Jerusalem. Or maybe that wouldn't have been prudent. There's a discussion whether this was a prudent move. But what is he trying to achieve? He realizes that Jerusalem's on the downfall. He realizes they're not going to be able to withstand much more of a siege from the Romans, certainly not without the resources. And he knows that leadership's gone. There's no longer a Jewish king. And all that we have left is the Sanhedrin. The Jewish court system. Upon the destruction of Jerusalem, that will be destroyed. Therefore, he says, let us maintain at least the Jewish rule because our unity depends on the Torah leadership of the Sanhedrin. Let's at least have that vestige. And Rabban Gamliel. Rabban Gamliel was a direct descendant of Hillel. What he was trying to do over here was he was trying to reestablish not just the court system, but the correct leader of that court system. And in fact, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, although he did many things to memorialize Jerusalem after it was destroyed, he withheld being the leader. He only took the position of the Av Beis Din, the head of the courts, and not the Nasi, the leader of the generation. He withheld that until the coming of age of Rabban Gamliel. And when Rabban Gamliel took the position, it was of the right age, or it was less threatening for the Romans, he appointed Rabban Gamliel as the Nasi, the highest leader. Because the line of Hillel was also the line of David, of King David. And part of what Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai was trying to do was trying to reestablish in a torn apart society leadership, strength, unity. And you needed to have that in a place outside of the raised Jerusalem. In a place, Yavne, with the leader who is somebody that the people could know would be the flagship, would be the post that everybody could be drawn towards. That's what Yochanan ben Zakkai is trying to do. And to a certain degree, it does succeed. However, within this leadership, and although this is not fair to focus only on these three points, but certainly for our time right now, there are three times where Rabban Gamliel's strength in leadership is seen not only in the positive, but somehow also there's a little bit of a negative tinge. Rabban Gamliel is very strong. He becomes a very strong leader as the Sanhedrin, and he has a deputy, his name is Rabbi Yehoshua. Rabbi Yehoshua is one of the people at our Seder. Right? He is the same time period, just after the destruction of the temple, who is living now as the leader of the nation of Israel, or the goddess within in Israel, and there are three times where he comes into conflict with his deputy, Rabbi Yehoshua. The three are the following. I think for the sake of time, what we're going to do is we're going to read the first and the third. I'll leave out the middle bit. We'll describe it outside. So this is in source three. This is a Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah. V'od bo shnayin v'omru ram. Actually, no. Let's just do it in English, just for the sake of speed, to be able to cover the ground. On another occasion, two witnesses come and said, "We saw it at its proper time." It meaning the moon. They're reporting about when the moon was seen, so when they could establish Rosh Chodesh. So they said they'd seen the moon at the correct time, but on that night, which should have been the new moon, it was not seen, and Rabban Gamliel had already accepted their evidence. So what it means to say is we have a particular instance over here, is that the moon was seen at the time it should have appeared, and it wasn't seen the next night. It was seen to be a new moon day one, but the next day it disappeared. Rabban Gamliel accepted the evidence. We still call Rosh Chodesh on day one, even though it disappeared afterwards. However, Rabbi Dosa ben Hurkunah said, "They are false witnesses. How can men testify that a woman has borne a child when the next day we see her barely still swollen?" Meaning, if the moon is no longer here, it couldn't have been Rosh Chodesh yesterday. Rabbi Yehoshua said to him, "I see the force of your argument." So Rabbi Yehoshua, the deputy of Rabban Gamliel, disagrees with the senior Nasi. What occurs? Thereupon Rabban Gamliel sent him to say, "I enjoin upon you to appear before me with your staff and your money on the day which according to your reckoning should be the Day of Atonement." Because this month was not any month, it was the month of Tishrei. Which means that according to Rabbi Yehoshua, the day of Yom Kippur would be a different day to Rabban Gamliel. Yom Kippur would be a different day. So Rabban Gamliel says, "Not only am I upset that you disagreed with me, I want you to come on the day that you believe to be Yom Kippur with your money belt," meaning as a sign publicly that you do not have an opinion in the face of mine, as the head of the basin. He's very strong, Rabbi Gamliel is saying. Rabbi Yehoshua went to Rabbi Dorsa ben Hurkunus, who was his fellow opinion, who said to him, "If we call in question the decisions of the Beth Din of Rabban Gamliel, we must call in question the decisions of every Beth Din which has existed since the days of Moshe up till present time." So he, Rabbi Yehoshua, thereupon took his staff and his money, went to Yavne to Rabban Gamliel on the day of the atonement which fell according to his reckoning. Rabban Gamliel rose and kissed him on the head and said to him, "Come in peace, my teacher and my disciple. My teacher in wisdom and my disciple because you have accepted my decision." This is the first of three incidents in which Rabban Gamliel exacts his decision very harshly, very strongly, even though he says that your wisdom may have exceeded mine. Meaning, he agrees Rabbi Yehoshua has a founded opinion. But the point is, when he has made a decision, there needs to be one way. And it's so important to understand this historically. He needs it to be that this is one way because we're trying to create unity in a torn apart society. It can't be that within there's even struggles. The second conflict occurs in Maseches Bechoros. What happens is that Rabbi Tzadok, this is in source 4, This is in source 4. Let's see, do we have time? I'm going to skip this one inside, but what occurs is there is a particular animal, an animal which is a firstborn, and firstborns are always dedicated to which person in society? The Kohen. So Reed Sadok, who is a Kohen, has an animal, and it's eating, and it slices its lip. Now, slicing a lip is a reason that cannot act as a Bechor, and in that case, it's now a Psulei Mekdoshim, and it goes to the Kohanim. The problem is like this, is what happens if you're going to have people, I apologize, Reed Sadok is not a Kohen, he is the person who owns the animal. So Reed Sadok says, look, my animal's got a wound. So do you believe him or not? The problem is that he has a ulterior motive. If the animal has a wound, he gets to keep it. So do you believe him or not? The Mishnah says you don't believe anybody who says that a wound happened, like this kind of small wound happened in an animal, because they have an ulterior motive. Reed Sadok says, what happens if the person presenting it is a learned person? A person who has ostensible honesty. On this point, Rabbi Yeshua said, there's a difference. I would believe you. And Rabbi Gamliel says, on no account. We don't believe you on this. And again, the tension set up. Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yeshua. What happens? The deputy or the Nasi? What occurs? Rabbi Gamliel says to Rabbi Yeshua, because you disagreed with me, I want you to stand all day in the Beis Medrash. Meaning, you can imagine, the academy is sitting, everybody's there. Rabbi Yeshua, who we'll call the second from the top, is there embarrassingly being stood up through the entire day. And in fact, people were so enraged by this that they asked the translator, the person who was proliferating that particular lecture, to stop talking until he was allowed to sit down. Because they felt this is such an embarrassment for the deputy. Incident number two. And finally, the last incident, which occurs where the tension on Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yeshua comes to a bursting point. And this is really relevant to coming back to our Seder in just a moment. Tana Rabbanan, this is in source 5. Ma said there was a story, but Talmud Echad, there was one student, Shebali Bnei Rabbi Yeshua. A student came in front of Rabbi Yeshua, our deputy. Amrul Amaloi, Tfilas Arvis Rishus Ochova. Is the nightly prayer obligatory or Rishus, how they translate it over here, optional? He answers, Amalei Rishus, it is optional. Bali Fnei Rabban Gamliel, they came in front of Rabban Gamliel, the Nasi, and they said to him, Amalei Tfilas Arvis Rishus Ochova. They asked the same question, is it obligatory or optional? Amalei Chova, it is obligatory, just in the opposite opinion. Amalei Vahalo Rabbi Yeshua, Amalei Rishus. But didn't Rabbi Yeshua, your deputy, disagree with you? Let's wait until all the strong people, meaning the people who have a say on this matter, enter the Beis HaMedrash. Kishenichnusu balai tresim, omad hashoel v'shoal. The person who's presenting the questions of the day asked, Tfilas Arvis Rishus HaChova, omad Rabban Gamliel Chova. Rabban Gamliel presents his opinion, it is obligatory, very strongly. Omad Rabban Gamliel Lachachomim. Anybody out there? Anybody disagree with disagree with me? This is a setup, right? Rabbi Yeshua says, nothing. But I heard via the grapevine that you reported against my opinion in my absence. Stand up. You deserve to be testified against. And what happens? Havo Rabbi Gamliel, Yoshev Adaresh, Rabbi Gamliel, would sit and expound that day. Rabbi Yeshua Omer al Raglav, and Rabbi Yeshua again was punished by having to stand the whole day. Ad Sheirananu Kol Ha'om V'Omru L'Chutz B'Satur Guman Amud V'Amad. Until again the people forced the hand of the person who's translating to the masses and said, don't carry on translating. Basically, switch off the microphone until the situation is rectified. Omru. And the people of the academy said, this is the bursting point. This is too much. How much is he going to antagonize Rabbi Yeshua? Three incidents, right? But Rosh Hashanah ishtake tzare. On Rosh Hashanah, he antagonized him. In the case of the firstborn, the split lip, he antagonized him. Are we going to allow this to continue? Are we going to allow Rabbi Gamliel to push his weight around like this? Let us depose of him. Meaning, this is going to be the end of his term. Man nukim le. But then the question is every time you replace somebody, there has to be somebody else in their place. So who are we going to establish? And the Gemara suggests a few people. In the end, they say Elon nukme le Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. We should establish who? Rabbi Lozar ben Azariah. Also the Omrule, they presented the case. Nichole lemar dilihavi resh mesifto. Do you want to be the head of the yeshiva? Do you want to be the highest leading person in this? Omrulehu, and he said to them a very important consideration, which is Ezel imlich bin shivaisa. I need to speak to my wife. Ozel imlich bidvetuni. He spoke to his wife, and what did she say to him? A very pertinent point. Omrulei, it resonates throughout the generations. Dilma me'avrin loch. You know, listen, if they're throwing out somebody now, it doesn't sound good for a new position. Right? They're probably going to chuck you out soon, right? That's what she said to them. A very, very astute point. He says, you know what? Rather to have loved than lost, rather than to have never loved. Exactly. Tennyson will forgive us, right? The point is that there's a special honor that we're being offered. Let's take advantage of that offer right now, while we still have it. Amrolei, there's another problem. Lezla Chayurta, you don't have any white hair. He's a youngster. He was only 18 years old at the time. Hahu Yuma Bar Tanisari Shanahab, he was only 18 years old. He must have been an outstanding scholar and leader. Israchish le Nisava Hadure le Tanisari Dari de Chayurta. And then he grew 18 layers of white hair that day. Haina de Kamar Biroz Venazaria Hanariani Kven Shivim Shana Lai Ven Shivim Shana. This is the famous thing that all the children said the Seder. Why am I like Ben Shivim, like 70 years old? Because he looked much older when he reached the position. I actually heard Rabbi Sachs said a similar, when he was giving over a similar shir. It's not exactly the same, we're going to end off in a different way. Rabbi Sachs was giving over the shir when he was standing to be elected as the chief rabbi of England. They said, well, you look too young. So he says, don't worry. This is the kind of position which gives you grey hair. So Rabbi Lozman Azari was elected. Now, this is significant because what happens is Rabbi Lozman Azari is only the leader for a very short period of time. Rabbi Gamliel afterwards apologizes, appeases Rabbi Yeshua, as reenacted as the Nasi, and Rabbi Lozman Azariah is given the Av Beis Din post. And he's able to, one out of four Shabbos, Rabbi Lozman Azariah retains the rights of lecture. So for a very short period of time, Rabbi Lozman Azariah was the leader. Why is that significant? Because we can always work out who the leader of a group of sages is by position. We're not going to do it inside, but the Gemara in Brachos later on says that whenever you have a group of people sitting, the middle person is the leader. This worked in the way the Sanhedrin was seated as well, that you'd have the novices on the novices are not novices by our standard, but novices in terms of the standard of Sanhedrin. We're seated on the outside, the experts on the inside, and the avbeis in the very center. Why? So when they ask opinions, the novices would get a chance to voice and air their opinions before being intimidated by more weighty opinions as they went inwards. And always at the center was the leader. Who's the leader of our Seder? Who's the leader of the story in our Seder, of our five sages? Who's the center? Rabbi Akiva. Who's the center of the five sages of our story on page one? Yes? The third one, three out of five, which means he's sitting in the middle, is Rabbi Lozov ben Azariah, which means we know the exact year this occurred. This story must have occurred the year in which Rabbi Lozov ben Azariah was elected as the Nasi in place of Rabban Gamliel, which is why Rabban Gamliel is not at this Seder. He's a contemporary. He's the leader of the generation. In fact, there's a Tosefta describing that Rabban Gamliel was having a Seder in Lod by himself. Interesting. So somehow this Seder is very specifically that year that this whole controversy arose, in which he was deposed of before being appeasing and being put back in power. Rabbi Lozar ben Azariah is in the seat of power. And now we should ask again the question, so why does Rabbi Lozar ben Azariah not hold to his guns? Now we need to understand why. So what do you think?
He just got elected and he's the youngest.
So number one is he's the youngest. He's certainly the junior of everybody over here. So he is not necessarily in a position to force his guns. But more than that, if Rabbi Gamliel was the one who was extremely strong about the policy of any dissenting opinions as the Nasi, it's fascinating at this important juncture, unity is created by submission. Unity is created by submission. Rabbi Lozar ben Azariah was the one who understood that the Seder should have ended at midnight. Yet, he submits to whom? Rabbi Akiva, his opponent.
Say that again about unity.
He creates unity not by forcing the opinion, which is the way that Rabban Gamliel did, and has a value and has a place in a fractured society. But he realized the time that there's a time to submit as well. So why? Now coming back. Why is the Seder so significant? The Seder is significant with context. To us, it comes back to context. These were just five names. These are not just five names. Four of these people were on two sides of a table. Two on one side, two on another. Disagreeing with each other. When did the Seder occur? It occurred at that incredibly important point in history where the nation of Israel had just had the destruction of the temple. They're trying to reunify. They have a leader. The leader's been deposed. And what's the new leader going to do? And the new leader lets the Seder go on till the morning. That's the significance of the Seder. That's why it's so relevant and becomes part of our annual basis. Thank you very much, everybody.